If a massive earthquake hit, would you know what to do and how to survive in the aftermath? The producers of the Big One podcast will share what they've learned today on Insight. The Guaranteed Income Pilot Program is underway in Stockton. The city's mayor, Michael Tubbs, will join Insight to talk about the launch of that program and give an overview of the state of his city in 2019. And we'll end the show with Oh Freedom, the story of the Underground Railroad. The play starts this Wednesday at the Sacramento Theater Company. It guides audiences through the history of slavery and the brave actions of those Americans performed in the name of liberation. I'll talk with the cast and director about the show. I'm Beth Duncan, in for Beth Ruyak. That's today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Duncan, in for Beth Ruyak. In California, just like much of the world, earthquakes are a fact of life. And while most residents of the Golden State might be pretty used to the occasional short quake, rattling plates, etc., most of us prefer not to think about the next big earthquake that is certain to come one time or another. But what can science tell us about what to expect? And how can we prepare ourselves and our communities for an earthquake and the days or weeks that come after such a disaster? The host and producers of KPCC's podcast, The Big One, join Insight to discuss what they've learned about the how to survive mentality and the eventuality of California's next big earthquake. Joining us today is Misha Youssef, the senior producer of The Big One. Misha, welcome to Insight.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also joining us, Jacob Margolis. He is the host of The Big One. Hi, Jacob.
Hey.
And Arwen Champion Nix, producer as well of The Big One. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
I understand the Big One podcast reporter team has spent months interviewing seismologists, engineers, tenant rights advocates, first responders, and others about what is known and what you can do. Let's hear part of an episode. This clip comes from episode 4, The Choice.
And so we're actually taking a look at the lake and the fact that the San Andreas Fault runs right here.
Yeah.
Do you know that the San Andreas Fault runs like right? We're like basically standing on it.
Yeah.
Does that worry you at all?
No.
Why?
Yeah, I came through the Northridge quake and I can't worry about it. You know, this is my home. I chose it. So We'll have to hope that it's not as bad as it sounds, as like it's going to be.
Do you ever think about it?
I don't think about it. Because if you think about it, then you worry yourself to death, right?
He's got a big home, a lot of space. They overlook a scenic lake. It's 1,000 yards from the San Andreas Fault. The Big One will be really bad for him and his family. But are they really any crazier than the rest of us? We know the Big One is coming. After the quake, you won't know when the power will come back on, when the water will be safe to drink, when you'll get fresh food again, when the shaking will stop. You could lose everything. The truth is, the biggest decisions you'll have to make aren't before or during the quake. They're after. Do you stay, grit it out, try to rebuild for months and months, maybe years? Or do you say, I've hit my limit, and go? Will you even have a choice?
What's this episode about? I think it's time to go to earthquake school. So let's get going here because there's so much information. Misha, Arwen, Jacob. Misha, let's start with you. What's an earthquake, simply?
What's an earthquake? So the coolest thing about an earthquake is that the best way to understand is that it's like sound waves moving through the earth. And that's why making a podcast about it made so much sense. But when an earthquake happens, there's, you know, mild shaking and strong shaking, which causes buildings and things to fall all over the place and potentially hurt people.
Yeah, and what we're looking at specifically in this podcast is the North American and the Pacific plates slipping in the southern San Andreas, about a 200-mile range from, you know, the Salton Sea in Southern California up to a lake about 200 miles away.
So what is a normal fault?
A normal fault would be, well, so the San Andreas, for instance, is the meeting place of the Pacific and North American plates, these giant tectonic plates that are shifting all the time, that have been created over tens of millions plus that of years. And so across Southern California, we actually have over 140 different faults. And those are a result of the pressure that those two giant plates have put on each other. And so what happens is that there are little slips, or not so little slips, that could happen on all of these different faults. So we also, for instance, need to look out for, when it comes to a big one, the Puente Hills fault, look out for the Newport Inglewood fault. And, you know, we could have, there's like the Hollywood fault that could also do a lot of damage because it's an area of high concentration of people.
Okay, so you've been talking a little bit about the different kinds. So basically, I mean, in real simple terms, we're talking about a crack in the earth.
Well, it's a little bit more than a crack in the earth. So the way that the earth is designed or exists is that there are large chunks of land that meet at certain points. And so a fault line is that point where two pieces of land meet. So these are plate boundaries, and those chunks of land are called plates. And different kinds of fault lines have different relationships between the two chunks of land that are meeting there. So there's something called a subduction fault, where, or a subduction zone, where one piece of land moves so that it causes a tsunami. The San Andreas fault, which we're talking about, it's two pieces of land that are moving against each other almost vertically, I would
say. Yeah, so it's a strike-slip fault. The San Andreas is a strike-slip fault, meaning they move basically horizontal to one another. And so when those two gigantic plates slip, you know, we could see up to, what is it, between 6 and 20 plus feet of movement on either side of that fault. And so what that means is that we have water lines, gas lines, all sorts of things that we need to survive here in Southern California that could possibly be severed. And that's really what we took a look at. There are also smaller faults like the Northridge Fault, which is, as people remember, in 1994, it's a small thrust fault that we didn't know existed, that when it did slip, it did an immense amount of damage in a very small area. So you have a lot of different kinds of faults, and they happen at the meeting of plates, as well as, you know, when there's enough pressure between those two big plates, it creates kind of faults in other places as well.
So visuals are great. One of you, tell me about the pasta analogy so people can see this in their minds.
One of my favorite things was when, this is Arwen, one of the producers of the show, Jacob and I were talking about faults and trying to understand just how many there are. Because one thing we have to understand about faults in California is that we don't even know how many there are. When the Northridge quake happened, we had no idea that fault existed. And so I was trying to get him to explain it to me in a way that I, as someone who isn't a science journalist, could understand. And he basically said, take a handful of pasta and throw it on a map of California. That's how many faults we have. They're just spread out all over the place, and some of them we don't even know about yet.
I'm talking with producers Amisha Youssef and Arwen Champion-Nix, as well as host Jacob Margolis of the Big One podcast, and they're reporting on earthquake risks in California. So let's get to the meat of magnitude versus intensity. And Misha, you want to tackle that one?
I think Jacob would actually be a better person to tackle that one.
Okay,
yeah,
Jacob.
So when we talk about that, we're talking about the amount of energy. Specifically, when we're talking about a 7.8 magnitude earthquake, we're talking about the amount of energy that's actually released when the fault does slip. And so, as Misha said, that energy travels through the earth as sound waves, and then obviously does a whole lot of shaking. And in our podcast, we spend a lot of time with instruments that also go ahead and, you know, obviously explain that a bit using
Let's talk about the numbers just a little bit. Everybody has an idea of what size they hear when an earthquake is reported. Is it like, wow, that's big, or that's not so big, that's minor? So how big is a big one?
Well, a big one would be a major quake. So that's going to be, I think, a 7.6 or more would be considered a big one.
Yeah, big one is more colloquial term, I think, at this point. There is actually a specific designation system that USGS puts out.
But I think what people understand is, you know, we've talked to so many people who are like, well, I can tell if it's over a 4 because that's when the car alarms will go off. Mm-hmm. Or I can tell when it's over a 5 because my glasses will rattle in my kitchen. And when we're talking about a big one, if you think about the quake that many of us think about down here in Southern California, which is the Northridge quake, it was big. It did a ton of damage. It took freeways down. That's a big magnitude quake, but you hear numbers like 6.4, 6.8 mm-hmm. around earthquakes like that. So when you hear 7.8, it doesn't mean a lot. But the big one could be 44 times more powerful than Northridge because the growth is different. It's not a small scale. The fault is different, and that's what goes into it. So when we talk big one, 6.4 might not sound big. 7.8 might not sound big. But the difference between those two is huge. You're going from car alarms going off and some damage to having, you know, thousands of fires break out.
Over a very large area, too, versus Northridge, which was very concentrated.
So when we say...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Did
you just say 44 times bigger than Northridge?
44 times stronger. So that's stronger and bigger is one of those things that we dealt with in the language around this, because the semantics are really important when it comes to this kind of science. Like, bigger could imply that this is going to spread to 44 times more of a geographic zone. And it's not that. It's stronger. So stronger shaking, more powerful of a quake because the fault itself is so much larger.
And obviously, I was just going to say, if it's deep in the ocean, it might be huge, but that doesn't mean there'll be as much damage as well. So where it's located.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And what Misha mentioned earlier about the subduction fault, there is a subduction zone off the coast of the Pacific Northwest that when that giant plate slips underneath that other giant plate, that's when you could see a tsunami. We don't need to worry about that as much here, but that's definitely a possibility in other places.
So when do scientists think that we will have the big one, so to speak? What is the theory, at least, or scientific theory on that?
It's roughly a 51-52% chance that it'll hit sometime over the next 30 years. However, there is, I believe, a 99% chance that we will have a 6.6 or greater size quake in Southern California over the next, how many years is it? Like,
soon.
Yeah, over the next 10 to 20 or so. And so they can't predict exactly when it's going to happen, but we don't say overdue, but we have gone past the average interval for a major quake on the southern San Andreas. And this is based on research by the U.S. Geological Survey. It's a specific scenario that they set out, a 7.8 magnitude quake on the southern San Andreas. And so if you look at some parts of the southern San Andreas, they, on average, slip every 150 years, and like part of it hasn't slipped for over 300. That sounds like a lot, but in terms of geologic time, that's not that many years, though the San Andreas is a very active fault. And so that's also why they went with that scenario, because the likelihood of it happening still feels pretty good, especially compared to some of the other faults in the area that don't slip but every couple thousand years possibly.
Yeah, I think that one of the lines that sticks out to me is we were speaking with an expert and they said, I would be surprised if kids who are in school today, elementary school, didn't live through this. Like, it's going to hit in the lifetime of our children.
So before we get to, you know, what to do, because I don't think any of us are truly prepared. Maybe you guys are. Your garage is full of water right now, right?
Mine is, but it took a long time to get there, so don't feel bad if you haven't done that yet.
So tell me, in a big quake, a 7.8 scenario, about the potential damage, estimated damage, human life, et cetera, and then we'll move along to what we do.
Yeah, the shakeout scenario, which is a very specific scenario regarding the 7.8 expected or anticipated on the southern San Andreas, says that we can expect as many as 1,800 people dead, which is, you know, a larger loss of life than we've seen in an earthquake, certainly, but also qualifies this as one of the biggest, if not the biggest disaster in American history. We also expect about $200 billion in damage. That means people who won't necessarily be able to go back to work, but also buildings that have been destroyed, houses that are not covered by insurance necessarily.
Yeah, we could see 50,000 plus injuries and something, and also 1,600 plus fires break out. And when we talked to a lot of these experts, they really emphasized how scary the fires were because we won't have enough emergency services. And this is, and the mayor of LA says this too, we will not have enough emergency services right away to help treat everyone. And so you could be injured and sitting there and needing help and not have any help come along.
And they do anticipate that search and rescue in this scenario would go on for 19 days. So Los Angeles is an enormous city. So imagine that search and rescue going on. We don't have enough emergency responders. There are fires breaking out all over the city. There are 1,800 people who could die from this. And that's on a scenario when we have a calm day where it's not super windy and the fires aren't spreading even more. So that all that without electricity, mm-hmm. with a lot of people not having access to clean water for days or even weeks or months.
And people in buildings being trapped is also a very scary thing, because even if buildings don't come down, it could be hard for some people to get out. One of the things that happens is that after about, I think it's like 48 to 72 hours, you know, people start to die of dehydration being trapped in some of these buildings. And so the idea of keeping maybe some water at your desk is not a bad idea.
Okay, Misha, Arwen, and Jacob, I think you definitely have everybody's attention.
Oh, okay.
Or they're freaked out at this point. So let's talk about what to do. This happens and you're there. What is the first thing you should do if you feel things starting to move under your feet?
Drop, cover, and hold on. You want to make sure you get to the ground under a table or something sturdy and hold on to that table so that you're not getting thrown all over the place when the ground is shaking intensely.
Don't stand in a doorway. That is not accurate. Please don't do that.
And please don't run. Whatever you do, do not run. You could sprain your ankle, break your leg. You have to be worried about things flying off of shelves. So getting under that table and holding on is important so you can protect your head.
And
what if there's nothing to get under?
Well, if you're in bed and it hits, I actually had a listener follow up and ask me about this. Make sure there is nothing hanging over your bed. We had a giant mirror that was unsecured to the wall that could like tip over onto my wife. So we secured that, obviously. But you're going to be safest staying in bed if you've prepared the room around you.
And if you're in another room and you can't find anything to get under, you want to get to an interior wall of the building. You want to get away from windows and to the most interior wall of the building and stand against that.
So you still want to crouch down and protect your head.
Yeah. Absolutely.
The largest earthquake I've been through was a 6.9. It was in Humboldt County, and I was actually covering it as a reporter, and it scared me to death. And what did I do? I got up and pulled something on and tried to get out the door as fast as I can.
And while it was shaking?
What's that?
While it was shaking?
Yes, the pictures were going back and forth on the wall. And the bed had moved from this position out. And so I was just trying to, my brain couldn't, you know, it's middle of the night. So no, you're saying don't run and don't try to get out of the building. Is that correct?
Correct.
Absolutely. When shaking is happening, you need to wait until it stops. That said, and, you know, something to be concerned about is if you're in an office building, for instance, and you immediately go ahead to run outside, giant panes of glass will be falling off of some of those buildings. That's what we saw in the Mexico City quake in 2017. Mm-hmm. People can be killed by those. You want to make sure that things are safe and stable before you do exit and go outside.
Well, luckily I was at a motel and the parking lot was pretty open and nothing out there.
Yeah.
But it's great information for people who might be in an office building or something like that. So what if you are in a building that collapses around you?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's a terrible situation to be in. I would say make sure you keep some water under your desk at all times. If you ever get into an elevator, make sure you have a bottle of water with you. And if you're trapped, Misha, you actually spoke to someone who had some great advice on that.
Mm-hmm. I spoke to Eric Baumgartner, who is the emergency manager in Burbank for the Burbank Fire Department. And he suggested that you preserve your voice until you hear people are actually around and are able to communicate with them. So instead, if you're trapped, try to get an object like your phone or a stick or whatever you're able to find around you and clank in rhythmic patterns, like in threes or fives, to get people's attention, because that's a human noise. That's not just like an object accidentally banging against a wall. And then when you hear people are around you, try to give them as specific directions as you possibly can. The other important piece of information is text, don't call. a lot of people are going to be rushing to their phones trying to call loved ones, and the bandwidth is going to be low. So if you send a text, you're more likely to get through than if you try to call the people that you love.
Yeah, so that text message should have as specific information in it as you possibly can give. I was in the kitchen at work when this hit. I am now trapped inside the building. You want to be very specific. And another thing, not just the bandwidth, but we could have a lot of cell towers down. So yeah, communication's going to be really difficult. And send a text, say where you are, drop a pin, show the coordinates, and then turn your phone off and save the life.
And while you're at it, everyone, public service announcement, have an emergency plan worked out with your family. Because mm-hmm. we have fires all up and down California. This applies to fires too, a lot of this stuff.
All right. You have survived. You're not trapped. And there's so much aftermath in a situation like this, and especially if mm-hmm. a truly big earthquake of the magnitude you guys are talking about hit. This would go on, as you mentioned, also for a long time. Who's in charge after an earthquake?
It starts at the local level. So what would it be? Garcetti. So let's say it's LA. So Garcetti would basically have to say, hey, heads up, we need help here, state. And then the state has to go, hey, federal government and other states, we need help here. And then the president ultimately has to sign a declaration of
disaster.
Disaster?
Yeah, a disaster declaration.
Yeah. And so then that's one of the reasons. I mean, that'll happen pretty quickly per city officials and state officials and FEMA officials. That said, it will likely take up to 72 hours before people start to flow in to help. And that will, I mean, it really depends on if roads are passable and if we could, train lines might be a problem. And so bringing in water on like trains could be an issue. It's going to be a mess.
So that said, you're in charge of your safety after an earthquake. You cannot depend on other people to necessarily help you. And that's why it is so important to have a plan before something like this happens.
Let's talk about that plan. What is the plan if you want to have at least the bare minimum of a survival kit, so to speak?
Oh, I love that. I've been so deep in this. It's 1 gallon of water per person per day, minimum. You should have, obviously, like cans of food, dried food, some sort of fuel to cook those things, and some sort of shelter in case, say, your apartment building, condo, or house is in trouble. And if you need extra medicine, you should have that around as well. So I'm shooting for 2 to 3 weeks. I don't know what you guys have, but I'm at 2 weeks right now.
So I think what you have to understand is it's really hard to get all this stuff together. So yeah, 1 gallon of water per person per day. That's also per animal per day. And don't forget about those animals. You want to have some dog food or cat food because they're going to need it too. You're sharing your supplies with all the beings around you. So you want to have that, but try and do it a little bit at a time. Get some mm-hmm. water every time you go to the store. You don't need to go and spend $500 right now at Costco trying to get all these things. Try and do it a little bit of a time and build up kits. And another thing that's really important is that all of your supplies aren't just in one place. I really admire what Jacob's done in getting ready because he has a kit in his car. He has yeah. a kit in his bedroom. Keeping kits in accessible places because you don't know where you're going to be when this happens is important, because the last thing you want is all your cans of water and dried beans in the garage, and then you can't get to it after this hits.
Not to mention the electricity's out, right? And the garage door opener doesn't work and all of the above.
Exactly.
100%.
Yeah. So rapid fire here. What pieces of information about your life should you have tucked away somewhere that you can get to?
You should have something proving that you either own or rent the place where you live. We saw after Hurricane Katrina that a lot of homeowners had difficulty proving to FEMA and other disaster relief organizations that they own their homes, which then led to payouts being more difficult.
You also want to have a copy of your ID with you, your insurance card with you, a list like written out of your emergency contacts if someone mm-hmm. else finds it, or maybe you don't have all the phone numbers you need memorized. You want to have those written out somewhere as well.
And when it comes to all that stuff, how to store it, you should have it printed, one. And I also have USB sticks in a couple of different places, including in my car, because in LA we spend so much time in our cars. But one of the things that, you know, I saw FEMA after the fires in Malibu recently this past year, and they were like, yeah, it's going to take a bit for people to get any sort of help. And so any way you can streamline that process is going to be good.
Yeah, anything that you think you might need, health insurance, deed, pay stubs, contacts, yeah. back that up on the cloud if you can.
And medicine.
and lots of medicine. 30-day supply of medicine if you can do it. Try and get ahead on your prescriptions.
For you and your animals.
And if it's something like insulin, for instance, which needs to be refrigerated, I believe, sometimes or all the time, you should consider that you're going to need a generator and a small refrigerator. And so you also need to budget for that.
That is Misha Youssef, Jacob Margolis, and Arwen Champion Nix talking about the Big One podcast. So much information, you guys. Thank you so much. And there's so much more. And you can get that information on our website. I appreciate you all being on Insight.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh, thanks for having
us. Thanks, Beth.
Check out capradio.org/insight for more info. You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Duncan in for Beth Rujak. When Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs announced plans for a guaranteed income program in his city, he was met with skepticism. But the pilot project called Stockton Economic Empowerment Distribution, or SEED, officially launched in February. 100 residents received their first monthly payment of $500. The payments are unconditional, with no work requirements attached, but recipients will participate in regular check-ins over the course of the 18 months to evaluate the impact on financial security, civic engagement, and health and wellness. Joining us today is Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to meet you. So let's talk about SEED in a moment and some other issues that are pressing, but I'd love for you to just give an oversight of your city as a whole. How is Stockton doing as you're heading into 2019?
Stockton is trending in the right direction. Our population is growing. But with that, we've also seen a 40% reduction in homicide, a 33% reduction in shootings. This May, we're prepared to give over 1,000 students a guaranteed scholarship to a four-year school, a two-year school, or a trade school. We're spending a lot of time thinking about how to do downtown redevelopment right. We have a couple market rate and affordable projects in the pipeline now. So we have issues with homelessness and housing like every other city in California, but the city of Stockton in 2019 is radically different than the city of Stockton I met when I was on city council in 2013, and even when I was first elected mayor in 2016.
So, talking about homelessness for just a moment, how are you guys approaching that issue, and what's on the horizon for helping to solve the housing crisis?
Yeah, so we're doing a state-regional approach. So right now the city and the county are working very closely together to figure out sort of how do we use our continuum of care to ensure that we're able to build permanent supportive housing for people. I tell people all the time, if you hate homelessness, like I do, that you have to love affordable housing and housing options that people can afford. Number two, I just brought a group of folks from the county and the city to New York for 3 days to work with folks from Bloomberg Philanthropies to devise a strategy. And that's supposed to be, that work's ongoing and moving forward. The city just joined Kaiser's Housing Accelerator to working with Kaiser and others to figure out how do we build more affordable housing. We're talking to developers about tiny home projects in the city. We're working on creative partnerships with Caltrans to employ some individuals who are homeless to help kind of pick up trash and keep our streets clean. We're doing everything that we can. I was also able to get Stockton part of the Big City Mayors Coalition. So now we're eligible for millions of dollars in HEAP funds to address homelessness as a city. So we're doing everything we can. But I know a lot of folks out there are frustrated. So we have to keep working and keep our eye on the prize, which is how do we make sure we house folks with dignity in our community.
And one part of that, one little niche, is those tiny houses. And they seem to attract people's attention so much. Do you run into barriers in your city, or do you have barriers against where those small homes can be put, so to speak?
Yeah, so right now we allow for accessory dwelling units, granny flats, so folks can put them in their backyards. But there's a couple of developers that have approached us about doing kind of a mobile trailer tiny home sort of concept, but it's so new.
Yeah.
And government being government, there's a lot of loopholes and bureaucracy to get through. So we're looking at our permitting process. We're looking at, is it state zoning laws? Is it locals only laws. It's taking more time than I would like. But I think everyone understands the urgency. We've made housing and homelessness our top priority as a council. So I expect to see some things online and in the works over the next couple months.
So let's talk about SEED, Mayor. And that obviously was a bold move on your part that you introduced to Stockton. Where does SEED stand right now?
So SEED, it last Friday, the 130 families received their first $500 disbursement. And I don't get to contact, and I don't even know who the recipients are. But I've heard from the folks running the program that folks have done things like fix their cars. They've done things like save their money. They've done things like take their family out for a nice meal. And that people were, like, crying and so excited for something as small as $500. And for me, this idea of SEED being bold comes from the realization that the status quo just isn't working for the majority of people in this country, but especially in my city. Where the median income is only $46,000 for a household. So for an individual, it's between $23,000 and $25,000. When folks are working two and three jobs and still can't pay rent because our rents are rising or still can't pay utilities, I felt as a leader, it would be irresponsible for me not to do something different and not to push the envelope just to provide folks an economic floor. So I think what's been exciting is that because of that bold step, I've seen other leaders step up and also propose solutions, whether it's Governor Newsom in his last budget where he called for a doubling of the earned income tax credit, whether it's Senator Harris, who talks about her Lift Every American Act, which is $500 a month for families who make $100K or less, whether it's Senator Booker with his baby bonds, or Senator Warren, or Senator Brown. Like, you see all these proposals coming out from presidential contenders around how do we make sure that Americans, working Americans, have an economic floor on which to build upon. So it feels great that Stockton, even the city of Chicago, launched a task force. And the task force recommendation was to pilot a basic income in Chicago modeled after Stockton's basic income demonstration. So it's exciting for me that the city for so long has been looked to as a city of problems. Like, you look at Stockton for what not to do, and now folks are beginning to look at Stockton for solutions.
SEED is financed currently by private donations, correct?
Yes.
Okay. What's the future for that? Are you looking at a measure on the ballot to provide money as you get deeper into the program through the years, if it stays around through the years?
Well, I think the first step is after the 18 months looking at the data and research. I have my ideas of what's going to happen. You have your ideas. Those listening have their ideas. But I'm really looking forward to the data driving our decision making. But I've said from the beginning, I don't think any city, it would be wise for one city in an oasis of many cities to be the only city to provide like a basic income or a guaranteed income or income floor. I think it would have to be a statewide or a nationwide policy. And that's why I've been so excited by Governor Newsom's talk about doubling their earned income tax credit, which essentially is money for folks who are working, who may be struggling, and measures like that. So I expect the data in Stockton to inform a kind of state and national conversation about, is this something that, does it work? And if it works, then how do we pay for it?
Speaking of Governor Newsom, you were part of his transition team. That task is over, excuse me, for the moment. But are you still in an advisory position with that group, with the governor?
Yes. Yeah, so I would credit the governor and his administration for being really interested in hearing particularly about the Central Valley and in Stockton. The governor has already been to Stockton since he's been governor. He invited me to sit with his family at the State of the State Address to listen to some issues facing the Central Valley, his plans for them. He put $2 million in his first budget to begin the process to bring a public institution, a CSU, to Stockton. So he's been a great partner and a great supporter of Stockton. We're thankful for his leadership.
And turning to that possibility of a CSU in Stockton, you also have Assemblywoman Susan Eggman, I understand, and a couple of sponsors, co-sponsors, introducing legislation. So it looks like maybe the tide has turned, at least in the approach to the possibility, so to speak, right?
Well, I think we're realizing that and thankful for Assemblymember Eggman's leadership for many years on this issue. But we realize that in the greatest state, in the greatest nation in the world, world, it makes no sense that Stockton, California, Sawatine County is the second largest metro area and the largest in the state without a public institution of higher learning. Especially when Sawatine County has had the fastest demographic growth over the last 6-7 years, as folks continue to get priced out of the coastal areas, they're moving to Central Valley. And the future of the state of California is in cities like Stockton and counties like San Joaquin. I think people are beginning to realize that. So I'm excited by working with the governor, the legislator, the lieutenant governor, and our assembly member to really figure out how do we create a CSU in Stockton. Not just for Stockton, a CSU for Stockton benefits the entire state because now we have, I think, 4,000 or 40,000 students were turned away from the CSU system, not because they didn't have the grades, not because they didn't work hard, but because there wasn't enough room.
I'm talking with Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs about the state of the city of Stockton. You mentioned crime and serious crime, the stats say, is down in your city. How did that happen? Are there programs? Is it a multitude of things? What made that good news happen in 2019?
We are blessed with a great police chief in the police department that's taken very seriously the need to community police and to build relationships with community-based organizations and with individuals. Number two, we have a strategy we've been running called Ceasefire, which has helped us become better data-informed in terms of who are the folks actually driving our violent crime rate and our homicide rate. And then number three, last year, the community and the council made the courageous step to add another program in called Advanced Peace, which provides even more case management, even more opportunities. And after 6 months, stipends to individuals who are selected to be part of a fellowship who oftentimes have been targeted because they've been either victims or perpetrators of violent crime. So I think that community rallying around, making a priority, I think programs like Advanced Peace and then the foundational work of our Office of Violence Prevention and our peacekeepers create this multifaceted approach. But we definitely still have work to do. This weekend, we had two children who are victims of homicides, mm-hmm. which are reminders to us that our work is never finished, that even one homicide is too many. So we're proud of the work we did last year, but we're still focused on trying to get as close to zero as possible on homicides over the next coming years.
How's the rapport with the citizens and the police department?
I think our police chief has done, and his staff, the police department, have done a really amazing job over the past, since I was on city council, so the past like 6 years, about really sitting in tough conversations. So we have a reconciliation commission. When our police chief has personally sat and had reconciliation sessions with many community groups, some like the Filipino community who remembers their buildings being bombed by Stockton police in the early 1900s. He and the city manager sat and did a use of force listening tour and sat in the living rooms of anybody in Stockton who wanted them to listen to incidents of use of force with Stockton police, not just in the past 5 years he's been chief, but in the past 50, 60 years. And he's been really good at working with outside partners like the National Trust Initiative and others to really figure out sort of how do we build community trust. And understanding that's not going to happen overnight, that in an institution like policing and a police department that has a history like ours has had, that the work is difficult. But I would say I'm proud of our officers for the way they've stepped up. I see them they go to as many, if not more, community meetings as me. Sometimes I tell them, like, you do a lot of policing and social work. They're so involved, but they understand there's a lot of work to do to build that trust up. So I'm proud of them.
Mayor Tubbs, you recently received the JFK New Frontier Award. What is that about?
It's a great question. From my understanding, I think every year the JFK Library and the Harvard Institute of Politics finds a nonprofit leader under 40 and an elected official under 40 who embody, in their opinion, the ideals of JFK when he talked about the new frontier in his inauguration speech in terms of pushing the political imagination and helping usher in America to a new era. So it's a huge honor, and I think it's really, the award went to me, but it's really about the work the community has done over the past couple years, and I used to be the quarterback for it. So I'm I was very thankful and humbled. President Kennedy is President Kennedy. But it was also a reminder that the work we're doing in Stockton, people around the nation are watching and are being inspired by it. So we have to keep pushing on, keep moving forward, and not get complacent because we still have a lot of work to do.
That is Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs. Mayor Tubbs, thank you for being on the Insight. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure's mine.
We have more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Duncan, in for Beth Ryak. The Sacramento Theater Company's production of Oh Freedom opens this Wednesday. The story of the Underground Railroad guides audiences through the history of slavery and the brave lengths that some Americans went to in the name of liberation. The play's director and members of the cast join Insight to discuss the play's context and some of the challenges involved in addressing the racist history of the United States and what they hope people will take away from this production. In studio, we have Miranda Lawson, the director of Oh Freedom. Miranda, welcome to Insight.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is performer Azami Abe and Trent DeGraffenried, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
DeGraffenried.
DeGraffenried. Azami Abe is excited to be performing in her first show with YPC, so congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Miranda, tell us about how the play begins. I mean, if people are going to walk in, what, you know, give them a little bit of what they might expect. How does the play open and how do you get into this story?
So the story was originally adapted for four performers, two African-American and two Caucasian, female and male of each ethnicity. And I was able to adapt it so that we have around 15 plus of our youth performers to be a part of it. And it has wonderful narration that takes us through, and they're sort of the Greek chorus of the show. They have an outside perspective of the action that's happening. And as much as it is a show about slavery itself, it's more of a show of abolition and the people who actually helped deter slavery and start the movement to abolish it altogether, both Black people and white people working together to make sure that slavery became null and void. And it shows the journey of, you know, bringing people from Africa into the United States, some of the hardships that were experienced by people of color, and then the heroic story of both Caucasian people and Black people working together to make sure that it didn't become a thing anymore.
There's a poignant time to be presenting this production. Why was the show chosen?
So the show was chosen not only to be something to produce during Black History Month, of course, but during these times especially, we see so many things from the past sort of rear its head again now, not only for adults, but for our youth that we have here. And it was a wonderful experience for all of us to sit together and explore the things that we go through now, you know, that one of us may not know that the other is dealing with, especially on a high school level. And we actually had the opportunity to sit down for about an hour and a half, one of our rehearsals, and we just had a full open conversation of, have you witnessed any racial prejudices? Have you had any sort of racial bias towards someone? Have you stopped something that you felt was wrong between someone else? Have you had a thought about, you know, prejudice towards somebody and you went, oh, I've never experienced that before. So we were all able to be really open with one another about that.
And performer Trent DeGraffenried, correct?
Yeah.
Say your name for me.
Trent DeGraffenried.
Tell me about your role.
So I play the abolitionist John Rankin, a Protestant pastor who used God as a way to show that slavery was wrong. And he was one of the middlemen on the Underground Railroad. He lived near the Ohio River, and slaves would be brought from the South up through there, and he would get them through his house and up to the free states up north. And he had hundreds and thousands of slaves come through his house going to freedom.
Well, what kind of effect has this show had on you personally?
Well, I'm white. I don't really experience much injustice. So it's really opened my eyes to the broader spectrum of life and life for people who do feel these injustices. It was really interesting when we had the conversation because after we talked about racial injustice, we got to explore more modern injustices, homophobia, sexism, different ideas of what people should be. And at that point, everyone was able to talk because everyone has experienced some sort of bigotry or hatred towards themselves or accidentally thought about it to others because of the past that America has in these situations.
And Azami Abe, how about your performance? What is your role in the production?
So I play multiple characters in the ensemble, mainly slaves that are going to freedom. But I also play, my main scene, a woman known in history. You might have heard her as Eliza Harris or Eliza Ice Walker. And so her story was published in the book Uncle Tom's Cabin. And so pretty much she escaped from slavery with herself and her baby, and she went across the Ohio River during winter time, so it's completely frozen over. She fell into the ice with her baby. Luckily she made it out, and she got help from a slave catcher named Chauncey Shaw, and he led her to John Rankin's house, so it's actually connected to Trent's character. And so it's just interesting to play a character like that who has a lot of will and a lot of fight in her to make it across a river that's frozen over.
How has the show, being a part of this production, affected you?
It affected me in a way where, like, when we were doing our talk during, like, the very beginning of rehearsal, it was interesting to hear not only perspectives from other colored people around me in the cast, but also when we got more into modern times, you heard perspectives of our other white counterparts and hearing about them, and maybe not necessarily having their own racial injustice towards them, but seeing it or trying to stop it. And it came with a lot of understanding and respect. So just having that started in the beginning really set the pace for how the whole cast feels around each other, which is very open and very respectable, and already having an understanding, which takes it into the performance and how we perform together as a whole family.
I'm talking with the Sacramento Theater Company about their latest production, Oh Freedom, that story of the Underground Railroad, and that opens this week, correct? Yes.
It's Wednesday, tomorrow.
Yeah, it is tomorrow. Here you go, right? You guys ready? So talk a little bit about Sacramento Theater Company. They have a fairly unique mission, and how is this show part of that?
Yes, yeah, so the Sacramento Theater Company's mission, they are integrating professional theater with theater arts education. That means the members of our Young Professionals Conservatory, they are able to work with seasoned professionals from across the country, under the direction, alongside of, as cast members, and they're able to experience a sort of theater educational point that isn't always available out in the community theaters and things like that. And we actually have the Young Professionals Conservatory. It's a 10-month conservatory program. And right now we're accepting auditions. It's for grades 8 through 12, and there's weekly theater classes, there's music classes, we have master classes, we do technical theater, there's dance classes, and it is by audition only. So if you are interested, you know, or you know somebody who may be interested, you can go to sactheater.org, and that's T-R-E for theater.org, and look up the information and schedule an appointment, or you can email education@sactheater.org, and get an appointment and join in and learn with all of us.
Oh Freedom, as you mentioned, opens tomorrow. What do you hope that people will take away from this show?
So I was able to tell my students from the beginning, along with their parents, that if there was one thing I wanted them to take away from this, it was the ability to feel like they could make a change, however small. Maybe having the courage for something that they wouldn't have stood up for before entering this process, that now having the experience, they would be able to just make that little bit of a change and have the courage to go out and see injustices and say, hey, you know, that's not okay with me, or to comfort somebody who that they see that is happening to. And that's all I wanted, just the confidence and the ability to make a change and the understanding for what people had to go through in order to accomplish what they accomplished.
And Trent, same question for you. What do you hope the audience takes away from this?
I hope that they understand that history isn't made by big people. It's the little men who help out and make change. And I think that that's also reflected in our political climate at this point, that we have large people in power that aren't the most fair or the most understanding, and that it's not that you can't make a difference. You can. Call your local politicians. Figure out ways that you can make a difference and make that difference.
Azami, are you going to be inviting friends and family to come to the show, and what do you hope they take away from the performance?
Well, I have invited my family, and so my dad, my mom, and like my grandma will come see it. And so I hope at the very least they'll take away from it is that there was more than just, you know, Harriet Tubman trying to help slaves. They had white Quaker people coming to help. And even I hope that kind of translates more to now that it's not just going to be the people you expect to help. It's going to be probably the most unexpected people you're going to think help you. So it's kind of like take that as an example for now that the most unexpected people will probably help you at the end of the day.
Trent, has this inspired you to continue in theater?
Yeah, it has. So I came up through the ranks of theater through SDC's educational outreach program. They came to my middle school. I did a show with them. Then I went off and did camps, and that's where Miranda got me into YPC. And it's given me a community, and this show has given me even more community because it opened my eyes to the larger perspective of life and given me a bigger appreciation for this community that I have and the community that I'm growing. So I think I will continue with theater.
Well, that is the show, and it opens tomorrow. Any final thoughts from the director?
I just hope everybody enjoys the interpretation that I've done. It's a little bit different than maybe your traditional sort of straightforward show about that. There's actually a lot of music involved as well. So if you have a musical ear and this interests you, then please come out. It's going to be good.
Miranda Lawson, Azami Abe, and Trent DeGraffen-Reed, thank you so much for being here with us. And we appreciate your effort with the show and wish you a great success.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
One last programming note, CAP Radio will carry a full day of special coverage on Wednesday for Michael Cohen's testimony before Congress. There's more on our website, capradio.org. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Duncan in for Beth Ruyak. Insight is produced by Bert Johnson and Cody Dravel. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Today's engineers were Antonio Munez and Anthony Van Hook. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our managing editor is Linnea Edmeyer. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. We're back with another live show Thursday. Thank you for joining us.